The Torah tells us that after the sin of eating from the Eitz Hadas Tovira, so Hashem says, "Vayomer Hashem Elokim, Hein Adam Haya Ke'echad Mimenu Ladas Tovira," that because Adam had eaten from the tree, so he had gained a knowledge of Tov Vira, and he was now Hein Haya Ke'echad Mimenu. The implication of the pasuk that now after the sin, Adam was now in this elevated state where he was Yodea Tovira. The Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, in the beginning of Mor Nevuchim, so he notes a question that a student asked him. How could it be that we know that the development of the mind, the development of the intellect, is the perfection of mankind? How could it be that after the sin, as a result of the sin, man has gained this knowledge? It almost implies that before the sin, Adam was like the animals, he wasn't unique, he didn't have this most elevated quality, and it's specifically after the sin that Adam gets, he acquires this yediyah, ladas tovira. How could that be? And the Rambam responds to his student that the student is misunderstanding the entire progression of events. The answer, the Rambam says, is that man was certainly given his divine intellect before the sin. He didn't gain that with the sin. Man was created B'Tzelem Elokim, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the ultimate intellect. It means that man was created B'Tzelem Elokim. He was created an intelligent being. And this is indeed why he was given a commandment. You can't command an unintelligent being. So man was clearly an intelligent being before. But the nature of man's intellect, how it functioned, changed with the sin. Indeed, as the pasuk says, with the sin, man's mind began to function within the realm of Tov Vira. As opposed to before the sin, the Rambam says, man's intellect operated within the realm of Emes and Sheker. Let's try to understand a little bit what that means. At first, before the sin, man's intellect focused primarily within the realm of what is truth and what is falsehood. Meaning, truth is to see the reality for what it is. Black is black, cold is cold. Without any distortions from the subjective mind or the imaginative faculties. In other words, we have senses, and the senses are our way of interacting with the world, of experiencing the world around us. And through our senses, we gain empirical knowledge. Empirical, coming from the Greek word for experience. We see things, we smell things, we touch things, we experience things, and that knowledge that we gain is transmitted back to our brains to process and to become one with us. Now, some of the information is objective. It's absolute truth. It's truths that are true to everyone, and they reflect the things as they are. So water is wet, and it is day now when I look outside. These are absolute truths, they're truths to everyone. But the mind, the senses, also transmits back to us things that are subjective in nature, things that might lead to relative truths, meaning truths that are true to one person and not to another. So just to define these different truths with an example. So a person can eat ice cream, and the mind is processing as we eat the ice cream that this is edible. That's a fact. It's cold relative to the temperature in our mouths. That's also a fact. That's an absolute truth. It's an objective truth. It's cold. It's edible. But our mind also senses that it's tasty, that it's something that I would like to pursue. It's something that I would like to do what I can to get more of because it's good, because I enjoy it. These are subjective truths. The Rambam, going back now to Adam HaRishon, the Rambam writes that absolute truths operate in the realm of Emes and Sheker. while relative truths operate in the world of tov and ra. We wouldn't say that it's tov or ra about a fact. Facts are emes or sheker. But the relative truths, what is good, what is bad, what do I enjoy, what do I want to distance myself from, so that's a different calculus. Now, sometimes it's easy to determine what is factually true, what's reality, and what is subjectively good, what's my reality. So sometimes it's easy to distinguish between the reality and maybe my reality, what I like, what is good. Originally, Adam had the ability to operate purely on the level of the objective reality, the truth, without any distractions based on his senses. So meaning he could ignore his passions, his tastes, his likes, all those things that define what's good for me. He could ignore all that when he was learning something, when he was gaining knowledge, when he was perceiving something. His perceptions, I think that's the right word here. He would be able to distill what is truth, what is emes, and pursue it, and distance that which is sheker, without his perception of emes and sheker being encumbered by his perspective on what is good and what is bad. So his perception of truth wasn't influenced by his perspective of what's good, what's enjoyable. His decisions were informed only based on the objective criteria, not subjective, relative criteria. That was until Adam and Chava saw the fruit of the garden. At that point, when they saw the fruit and they desired the fruit, they succumbed to the subjective elements of the experience. And their decision was not informed by the objective truth of eating the fruit, but rather by the relative truth that their senses perceived. Instead of operating on a level of emes and sheker, is it correct to eat the fruit? They operated instead on the level of good and bad. Is it good to eat the fruit? And that's why the pasuk, perhaps, stresses the taste and the appearance. Ki tov ha'etz l'machal, v'chi sa'ava hu le'inayim. It was good. It was desirable to their eyes. Stressing the sense perception. The result of this was that mankind lost his unique ability to operate with his mind purely on the level of emes and sheker. He was lowered to an existence where the line between emes and sheker and tov v'ra was blurred. So now man would always be caught between the objective realm of truth and the subjective realm of good. Man would ever be challenged to actively distinguish between the truth and the good. And this progression, this falling to a lower existence, is reflected in the Torah's presentation of nakedness. At first, the Torah says, Adam and Chava were naked. They were unclothed, and there was no embarrassment. That's because their perception of the human body was purely for what its original intent was by God, for procreation. The fact that it was pleasurable, the experience, or enticing, or good, was not something that informed their assessment of the body. But after the sin, the Torah tells us, that they ran to cover themselves up, they were embarrassed. Their knowledge of good and bad made them embarrassed about their nakedness, because they lost their ability to have that objective view. The element of taiva was inextricably linked with the naked body. The passion and fantasy that the senses experienced was so dominant in their perception now of the body that they could not divorce it. They couldn't divorce it from their perspective when they looked at the human body. They could no longer see the human body only as it is in the objective reality. They automatically also saw the pleasurable elements and the non-essential subjective qualities of the human body. One of the ramifications of this progression, or this, we really shouldn't say progress, this degression from emes and sheker to tov v'ra, is that man stands now to lose his own grounding and reality, because we live in a post-hate world. We live in a world where emes and sheker is marred by by Tovira. So when a person is unable to distinguish between the objective truths of reality and the subjective experiences of his life, so he gets lost in a world of dimion, of imagination, superficial sense perception, a world of relativism, where there is no truth or absoluteness, or at least not that he's able to perceive clearly. Man's imaginative faculties, his imagination, they take previous observations, experiences, desires, wants, and they try to make that into the reality because they've lost a grip on the reality. Now, dimyon is certainly part of the human condition in our post-sin world, and we can't escape that, and we're not trying to run away from that. But it needs to be checked by the intellect. And when it goes unchecked, when there's no attempt to clarify what is emes and what is tov, am I pursuing this because it's the truth or am I pursuing it because it's good? When everything is desire-driven, so then the dimyon, the imagination, runs wild and a person, in effect, is disconnected from reality. You know, when a person dreams at night, so he's lost in a world of dimyon and fantasy, and he's dreaming. And when a person is awake and he imagines things consciously, so he knows that his fantasies are not a reality. He's daydreaming, he's fantasizing, but he knows it's not the reality. The problem is when a person isn't able to differentiate. When a person gets lost in dimyon. When he might think he's smarter than he really is, he's more talented than he really is, and that's his perception of reality. And he has no way to ground himself in reality. You sometimes have a person, they think they have an incredible voice, and they sit and they're singing as loud as they can, and they're completely disconnected with the reality, they're tone deaf. But that's not their perception. They have no kli to be able to figure out if their perception of themselves is reality or if it's dimyon. If what they're doing reflects emes or if what they're doing reflects tov. And this is forever man's challenge. V'lo sasuru acharei levavchem v'acharei einechem. The Torah admonishes us from living a life that's passion-driven. That's dimyon driven. We need our intellect to be in the driver's seat. We need an unfettered pursuit of emes to determine and to help us determine if our perceptions of something is informed by objective perceptions or by subjective relative perspectives. Indeed, the word yetzer, like from yetzer hara, comes from the word yatzar, yetzirah. To create. The Yetzer Hara creates a reality where that which is objectively wrong becomes good. We've lost our ability to discern Sheker, and instead something which is Sheker is now looked at by us as good because we are passion-driven, because we are responding only to the information that the senses give us that speak to relative truth. So the Yetzer Hara creates a reality where we live based on our perspective of good as opposed to our perceptions of truth. And thanks to our Yetzer, a man can create, he can be Yotzer, he can Miatzer, he can live a fallacy thinking that it's truth. Now, we've painted a little bit of a grim perspective now on the human condition, based on our digression in a world of emes and sheker, of tov v'ra, or losing that ability to discern. But the truth is that the imaginative faculty is not only negative. I think that there are additional points and nuances in how we look at the human condition that emerge based on this principle. So the first point is that the imaginative faculty, the imagination, is not only negative. It is specifically man's imagination, his ability to not operate in reality, that allows a person to think big, to dream, to create in his mind alternative realities for the good and to strive for them. The Yetzer Hara is one form of Yetzirah, but there's also the Yetzer HaTov. And if a person uses his imagination, to consider things that he is not yet doing, but could be doing, and then strive for them, so then that would be a yetzirah letov, that would be allowing his imagination to think outside of the reality that could be used positively. In addition to this, I think there's also an impact on emuna. In general, we associate emuna, faith in God, in religion, in Judaism, that it needs to flow from our intellectual perceptions. And when we have subjective, relative, sensory perspectives, you know, this feels right, I feel inspired, it seems to me to be the truth. So we often discredit that, and we look purely for raw intellectual arguments to ground our faith. And I think that we cannot escape the fact that we have been re-hardwired after the sin. The reality is that we are hardwired, that this is how we approach reality. We approach it both with an intellectual perspective, the realm of Emes and Sheker, but we are unable to divorce ourselves from Tov and Ra. And as human beings, we never really are able to operate purely in the raw intellectual realm, the objective intellectual realm. We try as much as we can, as we've been speaking about, to pilot our existence using the objective truth. We try as much as we can to assess using the objective truth, but we never fully divorce ourselves of the calculus of Tov and Ra. That's always lurking, sometimes in the foreground, hopefully more in the background, but it's always there. But what it means is that everything that we do, including our confronting of faith, will never be a purely intellectual enterprise. And we also need to be informed by our experiences and our feelings. Not purely, that would be getting lost in a world of dimyon. If we purely did it based, if we approached faith purely using our dimyon, using our subjective relative experiences and truths. But we shouldn't discredit the fact that something might feel right. It's true that we will need to scrutinize it within our intellect, or else, as I said, we will find ourselves in a world of dimyon. But we will and should always be informed by our sensory relative perceptions of things. And I think that if we only are willing to accept pure, raw, complete, objective proof for Judaism or for whatever we're trying to live, so we're fooling ourselves. Because how we feel and what we experience is just—it is part of what it means to be human. And Hashem expects us to use those faculties as well in developing faith in Him and in Judaism. One last point, and that's a cultural point. Our culture, Western culture, the culture that we find ourselves surrounded by, that's what I mean when I say our culture, the culture that surrounds us, denies almost the entire concept of objective truth. Western culture is basically predicated on dimyon. The scientific community doesn't think so. The scientific community thinks that it operates purely in the world of seichel and intellect and objective truth. But even that supposition of theirs is, even that assumption of theirs is pure dimyonos. But certainly on a cultural, moral level, our culture is dimyon-based. It champions relativism. It abhors objective truth. Just to give a very current example, if a person feels that they're a woman, so they're a woman, in their eyes, despite the reality of their anatomy might be saying that they're a man. But if I feel like I'm a woman, so it doesn't matter what the objective reality seems to say. And that I think is where Torah comes into play. Because Torah is the objective reality of existence. It is the objective truth. So we need to be willing to accept in this world, before we drown in the sea of dimyon, when we find ourselves assaulted on all sides with relativism and the idea that you cannot take a stance on an issue because there is no objective truth. So the role of Torah is all the more highlighted as being that which gives us objective truth. Something, and we have to be willing to accept that we cannot necessarily find truth in this culture that we find ourselves in. It needs to come beyond our existence. And that's the role of Torah, to provide us an island of clarity, of perception, an island of, or a life preserver, or an island of MS and Sheker, so that we don't drown in the sea of Dimyon.